Freedom News Hour with Jake Towns, Walt Thiessen, and Gene DiNardo, Thursdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Progressive Radio Network.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds...
It's the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, and I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with Jake Towns and Gene DiNardo here on this Thursday, September 1st, 2011. Lots of news going on. Gaddafi is trying to govern Libya from a foxhole from who knows where. Meanwhile, here in the United States, Ben Bernanke announces that it's not my job, man, when asked about what he's going to do about monetary policy, saying it's a fiscal policy issue. The prosecutor of the Liberty Dollar creator, Bernard von Nothaus, declares that Liberty Dollars may be contraband subject to seizure. Goldman Sachs slapped on the wrist this week by the Federal Reserve. But the big news coming out of Europe, and actually an article that appeared in the UK Telegram this past Sunday, basically laid out how there is a rampant revolt, I guess you could call it, going on in Germany over the role of Germany within the EU regarding the EU's bailout of the countries that have been in trouble, countries like Ireland, Italy, Spain, Portugal, and so on and so forth. The current package that is before the Bundestag is in trouble. Angela Merkel's government is in trouble. She is having discontent coming at her from all angles, including people within her own party. To just read a few lines from this particular article, Mrs. Merkel has canceled a high-profile trip to Russia that was scheduled for September 7th. That's the crucial day when the package goes to the Bundestag and the country's constitutional court rules on the legality of the EU's bailout machinery. If the court rules that the 440 billion euro rescue fund breaches the treaty law or undermines German fiscal sovereignty, it risks setting off an instant brush fire across the monetary union. And the seething discontent in Germany over Europe's debt crisis has spread to all the key institutions of the state. Hysteria is sweeping Germany, said Klaus Regling, the EFSF's director. German media reported that the latest tally of votes in the Bundestag shows that 23 members from Mrs. Merkel's own coalition plan to vote against the package, including 12 of the 44 members of Bavaria's Social Christians Party. This may force the chancellor to rely on opposition votes, and of course that risks a government collapse. Big, big news coming out of the Eurozone, virtually ignored by America's major media. Little mentions here or there, but certainly nowhere near indicating just how severe the whole thing is starting to play out over in Germany. And Jake, we've been talking about this for quite some time, so it doesn't really surprise us. I guess all I could say at this point is, at what point are the American media going to start to notice?
Oh, we might be waiting a long time for that to occur. But sure, I mean, the whole thing with the European Union, we've been talking on the show week after week, is that with Germany, it's kind of like socialism, and Germany is the number one pig that all the other countries are taking from. So it's perfectly reasonable that the people there are starting to get a little bit fed up, and a lot more so than Americans, except, you know, between us, it's Main Street or Wall Street.
Exactly so. And Gene, of course, as we look at this from far overseas, this is a very familiar territory for us, because we went through kind of the same kind of revolt in to a lesser degree here in the U.S. with so many people reacting to the bailouts. It kind of makes you wonder, are the German people going to kind of neck wonder, or are they going to put up an even stiffer fight than the American public put up in 2008?
Well, the interesting thing, it sounds like the actual legislatures are actually going to, you know, stand up against it, which we cannot say for ours, who I think that at one point they said 90% of the phone calls into our lawmakers were against the bailout, and I don't think they listened to them too well, did they?
No,
but over
not
there,
really.
It sounds like they're actually standing up, you know, in the Congress or whatever, the Parliament, and saying, you know, maybe we shouldn't do this. So that's good.
It is a good thing. And, of course, one of the people who was behind that bailout was Ben Bernanke, chairman of the Federal Reserve, who this past week, after the meeting at Jackson Hole, basically said very, very little that was going to encourage anyone hoping for a QE3, and of course there are a number of investors who are hoping for that. And essentially, his remarks basically said, this is a fiscal policy issue. This is not something the monetary policy can fix, which is, I guess, a little bit of a reversal. And Jake, perhaps it has something to do with those three negative votes that have been appearing lately in the ledgers of the Federal Reserve, the Open Market Committee's reports.
Sure. Well, the big news, and again, the folks that were dissenting were just dissenting because the Fed announced that they were extending interest rates for 2 years at 0% or near 0%, and the dissenters simply did not want to put a time limit on it. So in terms of their actual dissent, not so much, but there are a decent number of those, for instance, Kosher Lakota, the last name of one of the fellows there, that is openly for some more quantitative easing or really just money printing. And that might be indeed the path that they take. What Bernanke did announce is that the September meeting, which is taking place next week, is instead of being a one-day meeting, will be a two-day meeting. So obviously Bernanke, a student of the Great Depression, where he erroneously believes that the whole problem was the Fed was too tight with the money and they needed to print up more during the Great Depression. Hopefully, or what he's probably trying to do is get that aligned and take a two-day meeting to get the consensus and move ahead with something. It could be QE3, it could be something else.
It could indeed, and of course he got his doctorate for making that mistake, and basically inspired a whole bunch of other economics students to do the same thing. But economics is not the only thing going on today. We have a former strongman hiding in, well, who knows where, over in Libya. And Jake, what are the details on that?
Well, Muammar Gaddafi, the Libyan's rebels, we're still not sure exactly who the Libyan rebels are, but they have taken over the capital of Tripoli. Muammar Gaddafi, like you said, is hiding somewhere from some unknown location. He has issued recently audio messages stating that he will continue to fight on and said that to let Libya burn. So he is for a total war. Apparently his government has retreated to Gaddafi's hometown of Sirte. Again, Libya, just like most of the Middle East countries, is dominated by tribes, and Gaddafi's tribe, although a minority, had been in power for quite some time. So the most likely composition of the rebels is just the other tribes that are trying to kick out Gaddafi's tribe. So his tribesmen will probably still continue to fight on. His sons, two of Gaddafi's sons, just made media appearances. Saidi Gaddafi came on and said that he urged his father's supporters to fight the rebels day and night. While Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, another one of his sons, called for a continual war and to fight them into to continue fighting. The quote from Gaddafi's audio response that I think kind of sets it out translated is, if Libya goes in flames, who will be able to govern it? Let it burn. We are still armed. We will fight in every valley and every street and every oasis and every town, Gaddafi said. The Libyan rebels have surrounded the town of Sirte and have decided to extend the deadline or talks for another week rather than blow up the entire town in the desert. So lots of things happening in Libya.
And which was the son? I don't remember which one, but I know one of them said he was trying to deny reports that Gaddafi was surrounded and about to be taken by the rebels. And his quote was, no, it's not true at all. In fact, we're sitting here having tea and coffee. We're preparing for the next attack.
In a van somewhere.
I mean, it takes a lot of practice to talk like that.
So his family has been allowed to just freely go where they want. Is that true?
Well, I believe also one of his wife and a few kids did leave through the Algerian border, which was reported by the Algerian government. But
were they sneaking out, or was that just the rebels didn't mind and just let them go, or didn't think they're involved? Or
they minded.
The wife?
They minded very much. In fact, they told the Algerians they want him back so they can put him on trial.
Oh, okay. So they snuck out of the country then.
Yeah, they were not there with the blessing of the rebel leaders. Oh, my. So we'll leave Mr. Muammar Gaddafi to hide in his foxhole for a while until the rebels dig him out, whenever that's going to be.
And
meanwhile,
then,
here in the United States.
We always talk about gold here. There are other reports that Gaddafi has been contacting African businessmen looking to sell large quantities of gold, which has likely been stolen from Libya's central bank.
Oh, really?
And that's reported by BBC.
Interesting. And there's a lot of stuff going on with gold right now, too. I mean, Colombia has gotten into the game after some 13, 15 years out of the picture. They are now buyers of gold in a large way for their central bank. So even the things happening on the real estate mortgage front, Gene, you have a particularly poignant story about what's going on in Oregon, how basically the whole thing is going judiciary.
Yeah, it's looking that way. I think last time we talked about that, there were numerous cases that were questioning title, and the thing had just become a mess, as it has in many other states. The exception was that most of the states that first had the problems were judicial states, and Oregon wasn't. But late last year, the federal judges began blocking these foreclosures, ruling that lenders had failed to follow one of these requirements, filing the mortgage ownership's history in county records. And this is necessary for judicial. And it goes on to say it also threatens to throw another wrench into the state's house, where data suggests prices are still have not bottomed out. In the first half of this year, foreclosures and short sales made up nearly half of all home sales in the state of Oregon, much higher than the national rate of 28.5%. Between June 2010 and June 2011, the state's foreclosure inventory increased 1%, the third largest increase among non-judicial states. Experts estimate it would take at least a year to work through the 26,000 properties that make up Oregon's shadow inventory. Shadow inventory is properties that are nearing or already in foreclosure, but they haven't yet been listed for sale. If foreclosures go to court, the process will take considerably longer on average. In the 26 states where judicial foreclosures are the only option, loans sit delinquent for an average of 728 days before a foreclosure sale, compared with 550 days in the 24 non-judicial states. So it's quite a bit easier to file. They compare it to filing on the steps of the courthouse rather than in the courthouse. And there's some interesting information here on the differences between judicial foreclosure and non-judicial. Judicial foreclosure, that's when the case is actually taken into the courts and it's required, is the oldest method, and that's been around since the 1800s, whereas non-judicial foreclosure started in 1959. Judicial foreclosure is more costly. The borrowers get a hearing before a judge where they could challenge the foreclosure. So this is different than the non-judicial. The only way that the it can be challenged is you have to file a countersuit. So it kind of helps the it helps both sides, really. Local sheriff actually sells the property after the court rules. This is judicial foreclosure. The right of redemption, there's up to 180 days after the sheriff's sales. Borrower has the right to reclaim the property by matching the winning bid. That's interesting, and that's if it is decided in court. On the non-judicial foreclosure, a notice of default must be filed in county recorder's office and sent to the borrower by certified mail. Notice of sale must be given to both borrower and tenants at least 120 days before a foreclosure sale. It also must be published in a newspaper of general circulation once a week for 4 weeks, at least 20 days before the sale. The borrower has the right to pay all missed payments and lender's fee up to 5 days before sale to cancel foreclosure. So there's benefits to both ways, although the judicial system is a little more complicated. I think it's also a lot more clear-cut, and it does usually take a longer time frame. So it's kind of an interesting proceeding, and I think the whole thing is just based on the lack of title. If the title was there, there wouldn't be any problem, and I don't think they'd be talking about going into the courts for this. And so it's pretty interesting, and it just kind of drags on. And as they say, it's dragging the housing market down, whatever that means. But we still have, they say, 2 to 3 years just to clear out the current inventory. So,
well, sure, if they're taking 728 days to clear a case in the judiciary, or 560 or whatever it was on the non-judiciary, you're looking at a year and a half to 2 years just to clear a case. So it's going to take quite a while to clear out that caseload, I would say.
Isn't that amazing?
It is amazing.
The time span, and you know, I think the normal, I'm not sure, but I think the normal missed payments themselves is 3 months before they can even start the process. So it's a, it seems like it should be simpler. I mean, I really favor on the side of the homeowner when they say, you know, this whole title thing is just ridiculous. And the mortgage companies have really dug themselves and, you know, threw themselves into this hole, all based on, you know, quick profits and everything, and I favor that. But on the other hand, to take that long to get your house back when nobody's making a payment, God.
Yeah, really, no doubt about it. Well, we have a guest who's going to be joining us today. Robert Kroner of Huffington Post is going to be coming on in a few minutes to talk about the Blue Republicans. So we will take a break and then come back after that. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we will be back after these messages. Yeah, run right back to your radio dial, because we're back here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, and here to introduce our guest today, Mr. Jake Towne. Jake?
Yes, today I'm very pleased to have with us Robin Kroner of the Huffington Post. He also is the publisher of WatchingAmerica.com. He has recently coined a term, Blue Republican, for independents and Democrats. For this upcoming election year, and we are going to be asking him some questions. Robin is a 30-something-year-old British permanent resident of the United States. His organization, WatchingAmerica.com, has 400 volunteers that are dedicated to translating and posting in English news and views about the U.S. from all over the world. Sounds pretty interesting. Robin holds degrees in physics and philosophy from Cambridge University in the UK, has lived on three continents, and has experience in the fields of real estate, teaching, and the media. Robin, are you with us?
I am indeed. Good to be with you.
Hey, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
First of all, I kind of like to get into the article that you wrote a few weeks back, that startup Facebook group that now has over 4,000 members, which was titled, If You Love Peace, Become a Blue Republican Just for a Year. I was wondering if you could go into that idea for us.
Sure. Well, it was really targeted at the audience of Huffington Post, which is largely liberal, straight progressive, mostly, I'm guessing, voted for Obama. I also supported Obama, not with my vote, because being British, I'm not allowed to vote, but with my writing. And if you recall, many of the big reasons for voting against the neocon Republican establishment and for Obama were that we were in foreign lands killing people, in lands that we're not threatened by, innocent people. And we also had a big problem of cronyism. We were all talking about Halliburton. And most disturbingly, by some measures, was just this complete takedown of civil liberties in the U.S., an abrogation of most of the Bill of Rights. And so when people voted for the Hope and Change, I think these were issues at the top of the list of things that they hoped would change. But if you actually look at what we've got under Obama, I think you can make a case that Obama isn't just Bush light, he's Bush plus. We've got an extension of the Patriot Act. The Fourth Amendment is more or less dead. We now have, it's not Halliburton we're talking about, it's Goldman Sachs and the boys at J.P. Morgan, but you've still got this uneasy, cronyistic coziness between those in political power and those in financial power. And there we are still in foreign lands that don't threaten us, killing innocent people. So it seems to me that if you voted for Obama on principle, out of conscience on these issues, on the most fundamental issues, even for liberals, which are civil rights issues, then in good conscience you have to become Republican just so you can make sure that Ron Paul wins next time round. That was the claim of the article. I went into somewhat more depth than that, but that's the headline.
Right. Well, before we go into the idea of the Blue Republicans, I mean, you said not only has Obama supported the war on terror, which was started by Bush,
But, you know, we were actively bombing Libya. We had a secret war going on in the country of Yemen. And, you know, for all the complaints about Cheney and Bush torturing people in CIA under extraordinary rendition, Guantanamo Bay remains open. The torture really hasn't stopped at all, to my knowledge. And what's funny is, you know, you've listed all these things, and I'm certain that they are somewhat reasons why, you know, so-called liberals and progressives voted for Obama, but where's the discontent with the president? That's kind of one of the things that I don't quite see myself.
Yeah, you mean you would be expecting more criticism from Obama's former supporters?
Right, yeah. Do you agree with that? And if so, what do you think are some of the reasons for it?
Well, you know, I think political allegiance is largely a psychological phenomenon. I mean, you have to realize that people don't coldly assess issues and apply principles consistently and then determine their allegiance.
They
We're
don't.
Not wired that way psychologically. No, they don't. You know, they like what most people do is we retrofit our logic and our facts to enable our team to win. And that's the way we're wired, and it happens on all, you know, both sides of the political spectrum, both ends of the political spectrum. And so I think that's most of the answer. And people only break out of their comfortable team, their comfortable paradigm, when sticking with it hurts too much. And I think we may be getting to a point where many people feel that that the left-right, the donkey-elephant paradigm, you know, of which Bush was a part, now Obama was a part, is largely, let's say, unhelpful. That not only can individual politicians not deliver the solutions in these basic areas, but that the system is incapable of delivering, as it's currently contrived, is incapable of delivering them. And, you know, Ron Paul, I think, represents a paradigm shift. He kind of transcends the left-right divide in many important ways. And I think many Americans are hungry for that. I think they're right to be hungry for that. Obviously, I don't know if his support will reach critical mass in time, but it's certainly heading in that direction.
Robin, you're talking to some Ron Paul supporters here, but I'm going to take the devil's advocate stance and say a lot of people think that Ron Paul doesn't have a chance of winning. What's your response to that?
My response to that is my most recent article on the Huffington Post entitled Ron Paul Can Win. If you look at any huge political, paradigmatic political change that might happen in a nation once every few generations, it's always characterized by people denying the possibility just before it happens and ignoring a lot of information that points to the impending change. And one thing that I find fascinating is that the idea that Ron Paul cannot win depends, to maintain that idea, you have to ignore all of the metrics that we typically, the mainstream, use to assess whether someone can win. Their ability to raise money, how they do in polls and surveys, certain aspects of their voting record. On all of these actual metrics that we have used throughout the modern era, Ron Paul is not just a front runner, he's quite a strong one. So I think a lot of these weird kind of refusals to see what's in front of our faces might actually be specific evidence that his time is coming. Because if the information about Ron Paul and his success doesn't mean anything, why is everybody going to such lengths to ignore it?
That's a good point. I think you're right, if I interpret this correctly, that it's the liberal or progressive element that needs to come over to Ron Paul. I think that actually it's easier for him to, it would be easier for him to get this vote than the conservative vote, although I think he could get that to theoretically, anyway. I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, I think, you know, there is obviously massive crossover appeal. You know, for all the reasons I've said, I don't just think Ron Paul is a possible candidate for let's say, progressive of conscience. I really think he is the best. Again, just by looking on record, looking back at the record. There was an interesting survey or poll that was published by Rasmussen, I want to say about a week ago, where they asked supporters of each of the Republican candidates, if their favored candidate were to lose, would they vote for the Republican nominee, and you know, whoever that might be? And 90-something percent of the supporters of the other Republican candidate said they would. Only about 50% of Ron Paul's supporters said that they would. Well, that, you know, that tells you a lot. That tells you that a large fraction of Americans are now refusing to indulge in the donkey elephant game.
Yeah, I'd like to call that the Republicrats, just kind of put them together as one party, because, you know, as you've kind of pointed out, whatever they say while they're campaigning, at the end of the day, the actions that they take are completely different. I mean, in one of your articles, yeah, you point out that one of the things that Bush ran on in the year 2000 was a more humble foreign policy, mm-hmm, to kind of get away from, you know, the assist of the, you know, the murders that we more or less undertook in Yugoslavia, and being a whole part of that entire mess, really. And instead, we, you know, we find ourselves in a mess in Iraq, you know, a country which had, you know, for instance, nothing to do with 9/11, nothing to do with Al-Qaeda, and yet we find our troops dying over there and thousands upon thousands of troops still stationed there.
I would agree with that, and, you know, I actually posted a little, just for fun, something on the Blue Republican Facebook group, which you kindly mentioned earlier, that there are two main parties in the U.S. There are the Republicrats and the movement around Ron Paul. They're the two main parties. And I would say to progressives, to liberals, to people who supported Obama for good reasons, you know, the reason we need Ron Paul is because we don't want to give George Bush a fourth term.
That's true. That's enough. A very good way of looking at it. And yeah, just for our listeners, what Robin's idea of the Blue Republican is that for Democrats and independents to switch, and really, I guess they would really just need to switch for the Republican primary in their state next year, which would just entail putting a stamp on a form and sending it into most likely a county office, and then right after the election, if you want to, you can switch right on back. Sure, it's a little bit of a deal, but really not much work at all is involved to be able to vote in a Republican primary.
That's right. And it's very important that people do that promptly, because in some states, deadlines are looming. And in other states, of course, there are caucuses, and you can just kind of go along.
Right.
It's very easy. But, you know, another thing I would say is, even if you were uneasy, if you were dyed-in-the-wool Democrat, and you were just uneasy about Ron Paul as president, you're going to get what you wanted out of Obama by having him have to debate with someone that outflanks him, practically on the left, in terms of peace and civil liberties. That's the way you need Obama to move.
So, also, somebody with a brain in his head.
Sorry, say that again?
Also, it would be somebody with a brain in his head.
Well, that's true. I mean, you know, I could, yet another reason to make sure Ron Paul wins the Republican nomination is, you know, would you want any of the other runners to have a chance of winning?
And that raises a very valid point.
That
raises the point because, according to the latest polls, Governor Rick Soundbite Perry is now the front runner of the Republican Party, and of course he's an expert at soundbites, at picking on what the latest popular themes are and saying, I'm in favor of that, and he's just went over the evangelical vote by holding a prayer meeting in Houston, and he's gotten onto the Federal Reserve bandwagon by saying that the Fed is almost treasonous. I mean, basically, he is appealing to everybody, including the neocons. He's going to be adored by the neocons because he was a big Giuliani supporter and so on and so forth. So this is going to be a very difficult candidate to defeat within the Republican Party. Again, I'm playing devil's advocate here because I'm a Ron Paul supporter, but can Ron Paul really beat him?
Well, I think on the flips. Go ahead, Robin.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I think on the flip side of it, you know, I think the latest Gallup poll that came out had had Perry at somewhere like 29%, and had Mitt Romney down the second at 17%, and it had Ron Paul in third place at 13%. But I think what's different about Ron Paul as opposed to the other candidates is that the other candidates are kind of diluting the evangelical conservative vote that, you know, might be for a foreign policy that consists mainly of war and trillion, you know, at least $1 trillion in spending each year, which is something that,
right.
You know, the Republican Party as a whole doesn't really address, but neither does the Democratic Party. So I think that in some ways, maybe you can comment on this, Robin, you know, the entry of more candidates that kind of fit the neocon Bush-Cheney mold is actually a good thing.
Well, you know, I think that Ron Paul has said that himself. He said, you know, he made the point that you've made, which is everyone that comes in, you know, just splits the vote that isn't the liberty, civil rights, peace vote, which is his vote, you know. It isn't also a constitutional conservative vote, which is his vote. I think the Constitution is coming back into fashion on the right. I actually believe that as more people of the center and left, you know, learn about Ron Paul, that the Constitution is going to come into fashion more on the left as well, as it should. It's interesting that we have a constitutional conservative phrase in the vernacular, but nobody talks about constitutional liberals. But actually, you know, the Constitution, which is the basic, the foundation to which Ron Paul always returns, is America's greatest safeguard of not just conservative values, but clearly of liberal values. I mean, that's what the Bill of Rights is.
Exactly.
So, yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think everyone who isn't Ron Paul makes Ron Paul's positions on the most fundamental issues all the more unique. It helps them stand out. And I guess in some way gives them more weight for that reason. You know, because each of these neocon types that comes in just adds to the proof that the prevailing paradigm is this old illiberal paradigm. Illiberal with a little I, meaning that the old paradigm, Democrats and Republicans, says, the job of the political class is to make decisions and shape the country for you. That's the mainstream idea, whether you want to shape it to the left or shape it to the right. And that's what all of these other candidates just, that's where they come from.
Exactly.
Not Ron Paul. And I would also say not Gary Johnson. And I think that's becoming more and more attractive because in recent times, Americans have felt in their personal lives, especially in their economic lives, that neither the donkeys or the elephants, the left or the right in the old paradigm, either the illiberal, the wings of the illiberal paradigm, have been able to deliver solutions. And it's now hurting them. And I think Americans are a bit sick of it. They know they have to step outside the paradigm to something very new. So I think we're at the cusp of that. I don't know, as I say, if we'll get to critical mass in time. I think there's a good chance. But we shall see. Time will tell.
That's a good point. Very good point.
One thing that occurs to me is that off of your last comment there, Robin, the popularity level of the president has fallen, and Congress, of course, is down almost down to single digits. And this is kind of a comical comment, but I wonder at what point the approval ratings are actually going to fall into negative territory.
Well, I mean, it's calculated as approval minus disapproval, right? So it's very possible. Stranger things have happened. And, you know, and that's kind of the point of my most recent piece on Huffington Post. You know, it's that we may be approaching a phase transition, you know, where we don't know how things are going to go. You know, just before Winston Churchill became the leader of Britain and the leader of the free world at the beginning of the Second World War, you know, literally days before, he was being written off as a kook who was going to be relegated to the political wilderness. whose views were so extreme they didn't fit the mood of the country. And in a very few days, in very short order, everything that he had been saying about Germany was proven right. And the rest, as they say, is history. Now, you know, we're at a time when the most profound issues that are affecting Americans are being seen to be right and are being felt by Americans. And the man who can be seen to have been right for 30 years, in some case predicting current political and economic events, and in some cases predicting them very specifically and accurately, was Ron Paul.
Well, I think, what do you think about the, and your term illiberal is perfect for the media, and, you know, Ron Paul has a great obstacle to overcome in the media. I mean, they virtually have ignored him, and you think that's possible also, to be able to overcome
well,
that?
Well, I think, okay, so the second to last article I wrote was called The Media, and as an acronym, Mainstream Embracing Disappointingly Ignorant Advocates, because that's what they are. You're watching a paradigm fail, and the media are part of the paradigm. You see, what the media do, and I say this as someone who runs Watching America, so I'm a kind of a media man. The media don't give you useful, meaningful information. They don't tell you about events that you don't know about and the meaning of those events. What they do, and this is no conspiracy, this is just naturally the way things work, is they reflect back to news consumers the assumptions that they share with those consumers, because they're operating through the same paradigm. You know, they are in the same cultural, people in the media live in the same culture. Yeah, they're exposed to the same media and ideas themselves. So what the media is mostly doing is reflecting our own filters back to us. And at a point of a phase transition, of a huge paradigm change, that's going to continue right up until the change. So I don't know that this will change and the media will suddenly wake up to Ron Paul. But I do know, and history proves it, that it's very possible. And none of us will be able to predict the day. But when it will happen fast, and everyone will kind of be looking back a few weeks later going, oh, yeah, that was inevitable.
So you think it's possible, even with the control of the media by a few corporations, et cetera, and all that, there's still the possibility that they could wake up and there's Ron Paul all of a sudden on the media?
Well, yeah, because, you know, look what happened when the media ignored the Ames result. John Stewart did his little bit. That became one of the most shared John Stewart clips in history. I write an article that, I'm just a volunteer. Nobody pays me. I'm just some obscure blogger that nobody's heard of at the Huffington Post. I write an article called Ron Paul Will Win. It's shared 18,000 times. And I'm on 8 radio shows within, no time at all. It may not be the media themselves that generate their own change. It will be their context that forces the change on them. But is it possible? Yeah, anything is possible. And I think we're seeing the signs of it happening. But it's weird how powerful the grassroots are being now in America. Because as a Brit, I certainly do see Americans as, they're rather unwilling to take to the streets. They're rather unwilling to organize. They're rather trustful of their political masters, who they let make political decisions and present back to them political concepts. But I think that's kind of breaking down. It's amazing what I'm seeing. So yeah, I there's something weird about the Ron Paul movement. You know, you identify yourself as a Ron Paul supporter, and then all of these people start getting in touch with you and offering to combine their skills with yours in some way. And soon you discover that 95% of Ron Paul support is nothing to do with any organized campaign, and that alone is a remarkable phenomenon. It's just remarkable. The division between Ron Paul-controlled support of Ron Paul, and support of Ron Paul that is completely organic, has no campaign management whatsoever. That itself, when the media wake up, will be a big story. Because I think it's unusual, not just within the United States, but on a global scale. You know, and so when things like this are going on that are so unusual, where there really are so few precedents in some ways, you can't predict the outcome.
Robin, I'm curious about one thing, because you've been explaining the whole phenomenon of what happens when you come out in favor of Ron Paul. But since your article about Blue Republicans was aimed primarily at the left, I'm curious to know how have the liberal commentators of various stripes, how have they reacted to what you had to say?
Well, you know, I would be able to answer that question properly once, you know, I'm having a television spot on MSNBC and seeing what kind of a grilling I get from Rachel Maddow, which, by the way, I'd be very happy to do.
But, masochist, you know, that you are.
say again?
Masochist that you are.
Well, no, I mean, I really believe in this, and I really believe that Ron has a message that the left should embrace. Although you're right, I have had a few interviews with progressives where all they do is preface every question with, there is no reason why a progressive would vote for Ron Paul, as if they just got me on to tell me that, you know. So I, you know, I'm getting a thicker skin as I do this. The reaction was broadly, I mean, I'm averaging over many reactions, was broadly very positive. Let's put it this way. There was a latent desire among a significant minority of the left to basically find a way to throw their weight behind Ron Paul. And I think the Blue Republican label just gave them permission. But it became clear to me, you know, I mean, a kind of a psychological permission, allowing them to set themselves apart from what may have to them been 4 years ago the dark side, right, whilst ostensibly joining the dark side, you know, the Republicans. Kind of gives a kind of psychological transition into the Republican Party for people who have maybe spent a lifetime criticizing it. The fact that the label was so quickly taken up, and many people told me they had already registered Republican and, you know, but used to be Democrat, or that they loved the idea and they were doing it. Or, you know, or just putting in the comments of that article that, you know, agreeing with the arguments that, you know, I've been making here with you. There's a significant number, and the Blue Republican page, which is for independent Democrats and people who have voted for Obama, who are now are becoming Republican for a year specifically to vote for Ron Paul, that page grows every day. And I should also say that all of my articles on Ron Paul are on the Huffington Post, so I'm always in mind of a liberal audience. And yet they take off. Obviously, that doesn't mean everyone agrees. Clearly, some of these hosts that want to put me right disagree profoundly. But that's fine. We don't need everyone. We just need a critical mass.
Well, Robin, this has all been very fascinating, and we're going to be watching very closely to see what happens as Blue Republicans develops in the weeks and months ahead. And, of course, we'll be watching you on the Huffington Post, and I presume that we'll be watching you on the new Blue Republican Facebook page. So thanks again for joining us today.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for your time.
And we're going to be back after these messages here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. We're back here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. And at the top of the hour, among the various headlines mentioned was one about the Liberty Dollar. You may remember that the Liberty Dollar was a gold or a silver. There were actually gold coins and silver coins issued by a private coin issuer named Bernard von Nothaus. He was actually convicted of all things counterfeiting last spring. And an interesting statement made by the prosecutor in that case. Her name was Jill Rose, chief of the criminal division for the U.S. Attorney's Office in Charlotte, North Carolina. She told Coin World magazine on August 24th that the Liberty Dollar medallions are confiscable as contraband, regardless if they are being exhibited for educational purposes only. She served as lead prosecutor in the Von Nothaus case. The Liberty Dollar, she says, represents a pyramid scheme embedded with fraud that had nothing to do with barter or trade. And barter is an equal and knowing exchange, which the Liberty Dollar was proven in court not to be. Interesting commentary, especially, Jake, in light of the fact that gold is taking off like crazy, silver's been taking off like crazy, and we're probably sitting on the doorstep of an even larger move coming up in the weeks and months ahead. I mean, what do you make of this?
Well, one would ask the question, who's taking from who? And the Federal Reserve is the one that's giving out the pieces of paper that have less and less purchasing power every year. So it's kind of funny to see that happen. But again, like gold is there's lots of things going on with it. One of the things is that CNBC of all things just started up a few days series of a gold rush, which was a expose where they went 2.5 miles down into the world's largest gold mine in South Africa. They took a look at a refinery. They got to go into the gold GLD ETF vault in the city of London, which was one of the first times anyone has ever got video footage of that vault. And they also just today had Jim Grant on of the Grant's Interest Rate Observer talking about a return to a gold standard. So it's interesting. It goes a little bit back to what Robin was saying with the whole paradigm. Like, people have been living in this paradigm for a long time. Like, you know, you use dollars and you keep using them, but you know what happens when the inflation becomes very, very apparent, you know, 10% or 20% in a year.
So there was actually gold to be videotaped in that vault. Is that the idea?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was quite impressive, I must say. I mean, you like to see that all those bars, you know, you like to match it up to what they actually claim to have, and also other tests and what have you. But for what it was, there appeared to be a lot of gold there.
That's good. If we can only get certain central banks and leading bankers such as J.P. Morgan to do the same thing, it'd be a great thing, not to mention, Fort Knox?
That's right.
Of course, one of the big problems going on with the economy doesn't get a whole lot of attention, but import-export is affected by what's happening with the fall of the dollar and the fall of the other major currencies of the world. And in fact, there are a number of factors that are impacting the U.S.'s export ratings. And Gene, you have some details about that.
Yeah, there's some interesting information in this article because it kind of takes apart what imports and exports actually are. And it's a very confusing subject. And it starts off, says the United States trails only Germany and China in terms of merchandise shipped abroad. That's the total amount. And it to me, is, and we talked about this last week, I think, the fact that Germany is ahead of the United States, you know, such a small country. But then the U.S. exports are a smaller portion of the overall economy. The value of U.S. exports in relation to the nation's gross domestic product ranks near the bottom of a list of more than 200 exporting countries compiled by the World Bank. The CIA World Factbook says U.S. exports per capita, this is per person, which in 2009 was about $3,400, were less than half of South Korea's, which was $7,700. But U.S. exports were substantially more per capita than China, which is the China rate is $899, and spectacularly more than Ethiopia, which is $19. It goes on to say that even when a percentage of GDP was substituted for per capita, by a slim margin, exports from Ethiopia are a smaller percentage of GDP, 11%, than our U.S. exports, which is 13% on the World Bank list. So this is just phenomenal to me. I mean, we obviously export a lot. We produce a lot. But in terms of per capita and in terms of percentage of our GDP, it's a very small amount. And I think that's, you know, that's our problem. It's not so much how much we export. It's how much we import. And, you know, of course, the GDP also considers government spending and how much of that there is. So the overall percentage is what's kind of turning our economy upside down, I think. One of the reasons, anyway.
And speaking of spending, Jake, you have a rather poignant article about what's happening with government spending, particularly where 2011 is concerned.
Right. The taxpayer has been paying for $1 presidential coins that have been really minted since, I believe, about 2001, or Sacagawea coins, now they're presidential coins. And what's really funny about this is that they were originally intended to actually save money by replacing the dollar bills, but since nobody's using them and collectors aren't collecting them, the U.S. Mint has minted over 1 billion of these coins, and they're slated to continue making coins in the 2016 at a cost of just under $600,000 a day for the metals and materials and labor to make these coins each day. And the coins are directly moved into Federal Reserve vaults where they just sit and have been used by anyone. So it's pretty funny. Like, it was an act of Congress that started the presidential series, which is a coin for each president all the way up to present day. But it's kind of funny to see the government waste just kind of taking place here. While at the same time, like the U.S. coin, the nickel, the 5 cent piece, if you take a look at the metal in it, the dollar has been depreciated so much by so much money printing that just the metal in the nickel alone is worth 6 cents. So you have a 20% difference just in the metal. So to mint nickels, I'm sure it's costing them somewhere around 10 cents a nickel just to mint them.
And meanwhile, didn't the Obama Budget Office project that we're facing a $1.3 trillion deficit now?
Oh, that's actually, believe it or not, that's supposed to be an improvement. Now, remember during the Bush era, the Bush era, the largest deficit that we got that was, you know, super massive at the time was somewhere around in the neighborhood of $300 to $400 billion. Now, since Obama's been in office, $1 trillion deficits are becoming the norm. This was downgraded from a $1.65 trillion deficit that was projected in February. Now it's only going to be $1.3 trillion. The Office of Management and Budget, which again has to take a look at how many Americans have jobs, and the reason they care about that is because you pay taxes on it, is projecting that unemployment will continue at 9% through all of next year in the factoring of this figure. So, pretty amazing figure that. It seems like from now until 2020, every year is just going to be a $1 trillion deficit.
Absolutely ridiculous. Well, I want to leave. We have 1 minute left. I want to leave us on a happy note. This is sort of a semi-happy note, but it turns out that today the Federal Reserve announced that they are sanctioning Goldman Sachs, saying that the investment bank must investigate questionable lending and foreclosure practices in its former mortgage unit. The action orders Goldman to review foreclosure proceedings by Lytton Loan Servicing between 2009 and 2010 to address, quote, a pattern of misconduct and negligence relating to deficient practices, unquote, according to the Fed. The move comes one day after Goldman announced it had sold Lytton, the 23rd largest U.S. mortgage servicing company, to Ocwen Financial Group. So a little bit of I don't know if it's just a bunch of a showpiece or what, but at least the Fed, slapping Goldman Sachs on the wrist?
A little late.
A little late. You know, well, you know, better late than never, I
better
suppose. Now we can only get them to do, you know, like a lot more of that. Well, when you're in the end of the broadcast, I do want to mention you can always find out what the latest and greatest is by visiting our website, www.freedomnewshour.com. You would have found that the interview with Robert Korner was on there, and that would have given you the heads up. Check it every week to find out what are the upcoming guests or whether or not we're just going to be talking about the news, which we may be doing next week. But Jake and Gene, once again, it's been a pleasure.
See you next week, and it was fun.
And we'll see you all next week on the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.